Well, hello, friends, and welcome to episode 131 of the Bird in Command podcast. I'm your host, Earl Breon. Today's guest is none other than Gordon Treadgold. Jordan is a former corporate warrior who successfully delivered complex $100 million projects, ran $300 million departments, and led global teams of 1,000 staff or more. He has helped clients reduce operational costs by $350 million, increased performance by 50 to 500%, and helped entrepreneurs triple their revenue in just 12 months. Now, Gordon helps to develop good managers into great leaders and also helps those looking to take their first steps on the leadership ladder. He is a highly sought-after keynote speaker on leadership, employee engagement, and operational excellence. He's been recognized by Global Gurus as a top 10 leadership expert and speaker. Gordon's work has been featured in Forbes, Business Insider, Inc., Entrepreneur, Fortune, and Addicted to Success. He's written four books, and his latest book, Fast, which is one we'll talk a lot about in this podcast, was a finalist in the Chartered Management Institute Management Book of the Year running. His clients include Accenture, GE Aviation, Allianz, Baxter International, Arizona Department of Child Safety, American Airlines, and many, many others. Now, I usually try to condense these bios some because there's a lot of numbers and things that pop up in there, like you just heard with Gordon's. But with his, I really thought it was very important to keep these in because they really speak to the breadth and depth of his knowledge. And in this podcast, we do wander around a little bit. We end up talking about rugby quite a bit, which is not a topic I've ever talked about on this podcast much before, but you'll see where that conversation goes. But Gordon's really kind of been there, done that, and he's done it all around the world. And I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. I think there's a little bit of something here for everybody. And I'm just going to shut up now and get out of the way and let you get into this outstanding conversation that I had the honor of having with Gordon Treadgold. Gordon, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely love it.
Oh, no, I'm loving this. You know, for the listeners who weren't privy to it, we had a really great pre-roll conversation, and I'm just excited to get into this interview because I think it's going to be some great conversation here. We've already hit on a lot of topics. Probably should have been hit and record then. But anyways, let's start you off where we start everybody off, Gordon. When you hear the phrase burden of command, what does that mean to you?
So I love that question because I think it's I'm definitely going to ask that when I start interviewing people for leadership roles, because for me leadership is not a burden. For me, leadership is an opportunity for me to be involved in shaping the outcome. And you know, when I first stepped into leadership, that was often with, you know, using my expertise, my knowledge, my skills to, you know, lead from the front and get the team across the line. Whereas, you know, latterly, as I've progressed and moved on, it's about helping the team come up with the right solution and, you know, setting them up to be successful and then getting the thing across the line. And I think if you see leadership as a burden, then maybe leadership's actually not for you. Leadership's an opportunity to get the best out of people and to move them forward. Now, having said that, there is a burden to leadership. And again, this is in an interview question. It would be great to see how people feel about that. And the burden of leadership to me is that if we fail, I'm the one that is accountable for that. If we fail, it's on my dime. The buck stops with me. And I think that's the burden of leadership. You can't duck it. If you choose to step forward and shape the direction, select the team, coach the team, give them the tools and set them up for success, and it doesn't happen, then the book rests with you. But for me, I'm confident in my own abilities, and I would rather be leading and helping design the solution than being back in the pack and maybe watching somebody else shape a solution that I don't feel comfortable with.
So yeah,
that's how I see it.
Yeah, no, I like it. I mean, there's a lot there, and, you know, and I agree with you. Like, and I 100% agree. Like, if you look at leadership as a burden in the sense of, oh man, this is something I have to do, and you hate going to work because of that responsibility, then yeah, I agree with you. Get out of it, right?
Get out of it. It's not for you.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's where we get, correct me if I'm wrong, this is my experiences, maybe yours are a little different, but I think that's where we end up with all of these terrible leaders in the position they're in right now. They feel
absolutely.
Yeah. Go ahead.
They want to be leaders, but they don't want to have to lead for the books that they're getting and the position that they hold.
Yeah, well, exactly, because we've gotten people, especially in corporate America, and that are locked into this idea that I have to get promoted, I have to take that next step, and we get people promoted beyond their means, but they get the title, they get the money, and they're miserable. And they take it out on everybody else, and now we have employee disengagement at an all-time high.
Yeah.
We have all these issues, right?
Well, I just want to interrupt you with that for a second, because, employee disengagement is at an all-time high. And do you know what the level of employee engagement currently is at the moment?
The last I heard, engagement is only like 25-30%.
The one I saw, there's two. There's the one that's global, and that's around 15%, but I don't believe that because I've worked in multiple countries. In the US, employee engagement is around, or it was in 2020, 33%, which is that means two-thirds of your team are either, and I think there's 14% that are actively disengaged. So in your boat, a third are rowing forward, there's around 55% who are passengers, and there's 14% who are rowing in the opposite direction. And that's a problem. So it's 33%. Here's the killer question. The last time they run it, because they don't like to run this survey, what was management engagement?
Yeah.
30%. And so we're blaming employees for being disengaged, yet managers are 30% disengaged. More managers than employees are disengaged. And one of my favorite quotes is, "You can't light a fire with a damp match." So if if the managers are not engaged, then of course the employees are not going to be engaged. And we look at employee disengagement as a problem, but the root cause is management disengagement. Because managers have to engage, and if they ain't engaged, it ain't gonna engage their employees. And we duck this all the time. And I think the reason why we don't do more management engagement surveys is because it's managers that are paying for those surveys. And why would I pay money for a survey that tells me I'm the problem? You know what? Let's blame the employees. I like that.
Exactly. It's the classic blame shifting, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And now I don't want to say that that's the case in every single organization, but, you know, when Gallup, who were a reputable company, do a survey and only 30% managers are engaged and 33% employees, I can tell you, I know where the problem is. And the bigger problem is not in employee disengagement, it's in management disengagement. And that's what we need to fix. And as you say, a lot of that comes from people getting promoted into positions where they're above their capability, which makes it difficult for them to engage. And then you've got people they want the money, but they don't want to do the job. And we used to see this in IT all the time, that they were always looking for, how could we play technical experts, the guys that we really needed doing the job, enough money to keep them interested rather than taking a leadership track? Because if an expert, you know, let's say an expert salary tops out at 100,000 and a leader's salary goes up to 150, 200, then you're going to get experts thinking, well, if I want 200, I've now got to go down that path. And they might not have the skills to do that job, but they're just not getting the same income for what their expertise is. And I think we create that problem. Another statistic from Gallup that I love, 87% of the time, let's just let that number settle, 87% of the time, companies promote the wrong people into leadership positions.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got this, so you've got 30% of managers that are engaged, 70% disengaged, and you've got a conveyor belt promoting 87% of the wrong people into leadership.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think
how does that fix it?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, and it goes into that whole thing to where, you know, organizations really don't know how to hire for the right person to be in those roles. You know, it's that reliance on, oh, you were the greatest bean counter that ever counted beans. Obviously, you can lead a group of other bean counters, right?
Yeah, so we talked about football earlier, and I'm a Green Bay Packers fan. I'm not going to apologize for that. Who is the greatest football coach that's ever been involved in coaching the game?
Well, even Belichick goes back to Lambeau.
I think six Super Bowls, it's Belichick. Where did Belichick play football?
That's a great question.
Yeah. How many great players go on to be great coaches and leaders of organizations?
Who was the
coach in Indy? I think he was a cornerback for the Steelers, was he?
Oh yeah, Tony Dungy.
Tony Dungy. I don't remember him as a great player.
No.
I remember him as a player, but great coach. And this is while ever we're promoting the experts, and the experts apply because they want more money, and they, you know, they get told they're experts, and they get built up. While ever we're promoting the experts, we're missing out on Tony Dungy. We're missing out on Bill Parcells and Bill Belichick and all of those other people that go on. And it's the same in other sports. I'm sure it's the same in, you know, Wayne Gretzky. Where's he managing now? Ice hockey team is he managing? And, you know, in a lot of the other sports, it's not the greatest players. Yet companies, we take our experts, we see them as they rise to the top of the player pool, and then we pick them up and we put them into the management position, and, you know, some flourish, but the majority fail. And this is where that 87% of the time we're promoting the wrong people. I did an article and created a graphic on this, and I call it the five levels of leadership. And the kind of five levels of leadership, as I see them, is, you know, level one is the informal leader, where you don't have the position, but you're leading anyway. You're being the role model. You're supporting people. You're setting the example. You're stepping up, trying to fix things. Then you've got level two, which is kind of like the team leader, where you're managing small groups of people. Then the next level is expert leader, where you are an expert in what you are doing. So, you know, it might be sales. You might be the greatest salesperson ever. And then we put you into charge of leading sales teams. And you might do well at that. And then you've got levels four and level five, where now you have to lead outside of your area of expertise. So for me, my background was in IT. I worked in development. But when I made the big I led a lot of projects. But when I got the big promotion, I went from managing developers, but also database administrators, which I'd never done, network engineers, stuff I'd never done, service desk people, an area I'd never done. So nearly 80% of the people that reported to me were doing a job I'd never done. So my expertise in development is now no longer going to serve me. And this is where a lot of people trip and fall, you know, as an expert leader, leading in their area of expertise, good to go. But when you take that next step up and you have to be about engaging and empowering people, it's a completely different skill set. The skills that got you to an expert leader won't take you further. You've got to develop people skills. You've got to be able to engage teams, inspire teams, motivate teams. And then the fifth level of leadership, which I actually call the inspiring leadership level, that's where you're then into creating culture and you're creating long-term sustainable results, implementing change, you know, possibly, you know, CEO kind of role or head of a large department. And that's slightly different skills from the employee engaging and empowering, because now you're probably leading more people where you don't have hands-on contact with them. So now it's about inspiring them and creating a culture that those people are going to be interested in being involved in and following. So for me, that's those are kind of like the levels of leadership, and that expert level three is kind of a plateau for a lot of people, and if we move them into level four without the skills, they're going to crash and burn.
No, I like everything you said there, and it makes a whole lot of sense, because it reminds me, so again, most of my listeners know I grew up in Northeast Tennessee. And I grew up in the Peyton Manning years at UT. So, you know, I remember him from there. And when I got to Indy, you know, he was obviously here in Indianapolis and went on a lot of games.
He followed you.
Right? but, you know, I remember – so what rang in my brain right there as you were talking about that is I remember like a year or two before he actually – well, actually before he ended up going to Denver. But so it was about 4 years before he retired. Somebody was talking to him about, you know, hey, when you retire, are you going to be a coach? And he flat out said no. And they're like, whoa, wait a minute, why? You're like the one of the greatest technicians and strategic people that the game's ever seen play at that position.
Yeah.
And he said, that's exactly why. He goes, I couldn't be a coach because I would be too much of a micromanager, and whoever played for me wouldn't have a good time because I can't. He said, I can't not be involved in every aspect, and that's not good for a quarterback to have a coach like that. And I thought that was like great self-awareness, right?
Absolutely. And the even if he could do that, he can't do the hands-on with the defense. Yeah. He didn't play on defense. So you're now managing at different levels. You know, if with a quarterback, you're all over it. With the linemen, yeah, you're probably giving them a great deal. You know, block this, do that. Receivers, you know what? This is where you need to go, guys. Running back, didn't really do a lot of that. Defense, no clue. And you've got to inspire all of the organization. Almost every area needs to get the same level of time from you, that same level of input, same level of direction, same level of motivation. But if you focus, and this is what happens with people when they go to that next level, level four, engaging and empowering leader, they struggle. What they do is they revert back to what they're good at. So, you know, Peyton's, he's been made the head coach. He realizes it's not going well. He goes, you know what? I'll just go back and coach the quarterback because I can do that. And then you take your eye off the other things. You micromanage this area, that pisses them off, and the other people have no clue what they're supposed to be doing because you're no longer leading and managing them. And I see that all the time. And this is why, you know, people, and it's an easy thing to do because the people who are great at their jobs always think, I can do the next job. And the role of HR is to, you know, create and nurture leaders. And some people will make the jump as an expert, give them the skills. But more often than not, I remember I'd been in a leadership position for a year before I got any management training, not leadership training, management training, and it was another 4 years before I got any leadership training. And I'll tell you, this is a true story, and I often share this with people. So I was kind of like Peyton Manning in the project I was working on. I'd been the head of design, I'd been the head of testing, I'd been the head of implementation, and then the project manager got pregnant, nothing to do with me, and went on maternity leave, and my boss said to me, could you take over as project manager? Nobody knows more about the project than you do. Nobody knows the teams and what they do more than you do. Would you be willing to take over? And I said, yeah, sure. And my first day, the first hour, I think the role I was doing prior to that was test manager, and my first hour in overall charge, the test manager came up to me and she said, I need to talk with you. There's an issue and we need to do that right now. And I said, okay, let's go into one of the offices. This will be easy. I know everything about testing. I've worked with you. I coached you in there. Sat her down and I said, okay, what's the problem? And she said, I have a lump in my breast. I think it's cancer.
Mm.
And I was like, sorry, what? She said, I have a lump in my breast. I think it's cancer. I was like, is it nothing to do with the project? I know everything about the project. She said, no, I have a lump in my breast. I think it's cancer. What should I do? And in that first hour, I realized leadership was a whole different ball game. And it was a wake up call that I needed a completely different set of skills. So I went and started reading about, and I said to her, look, you know what you need to do? Have you been to see the doctor? Have you spoken to your partner? Blah, 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 blah. Try to calm her down, and everything worked out. And it was just a lump. Fortunately, it was just a lump. But after that, I thought, wow, that was my first hour. I need to be getting on this people train, and I need to start reading more. If the company won't train me, I will go and figure out what I need to do to become a better leader and develop the skills that I need to have.
Mm. So there was a bunch there, right? And there's two things. No, it was good. I mean, it was gold. And I know the listeners are getting a lot out of this, but it reminded me of two things. I'll share one, which is a quick story that kind of backs up what you were just saying.
Yeah.
You mentioned him before, Bill Parcells.
Yeah.
And I mentioned the story on the podcast a couple of times before, but I remember watching him getting inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And I remember there was one of the reporters asked him kind of, the classic question, Coach Parcells, what was your biggest failure as a coach? And I remember he didn't skip a beat. He looked at him and he said, Lawrence Taylor.
Yeah.
And
I would say so too, yeah.
They look at him like, but he was a great linebacker. He's in the Hall of Fame. He's like, yeah.
First defensive MVP.
Yeah. He goes, but look at all the trouble he's in. He goes, I spent too much time making him a great football player. I didn't spend enough time helping him become a better human being.
Yeah.
And the second one you mentioned there about the training piece, I'd love to see these numbers revisited because I think these are based off of a 2012 study. But Harvard Business Review has a piece of research out there where they, I want to say it was 20-some thousand people across the globe, across all sectors, and they asked them essentially two questions. What age were you first put into your first formal leadership role? And what age did you receive your first formal leadership training? And there was a 10-year gap where people were put in their first role, and then a decade later, they received training to be in that role. That's neglect.
I would imagine they got management training in the interim because people I kept getting offered management training, but management and leadership are two completely different things, and I think we still struggle to see to understand and know what leadership is. And when I'd been in that role for a year. And they said, okay, we're going to give you some training. I was like, yeah, great. And they sent me on a Prince project management training. And I went in and sat in, and the guy said, okay, before we start, we're just going to ask a quick question to put everybody in the mood and, figure out where we are on this. And they said, what are the top 10 challenges for project managers on projects? And he said to me, Gordon, I know you've been doing this for a year. Most of these others haven't been leading. So let's let them go first, and then you can add anything to the list. And we went through, and it was like, budget, scope, creep, uncertainty about requirements, lack of stakeholder buy-in, blah, 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 blah. And he said, okay, yep, we've got our 10. I think we're good to go. He said, I was going to ask you, Gordon, if there's anything you want to add, but I think we've got everything here. And I said, hang on a second. There's one that's missing, and it should be top of the list. And he said, what's that? I said, people. I said, people are the biggest challenge on any project. And he said, no, they're not. People are not on issue. These are the top 10. And I thought, if you're not even going to talk about, if it doesn't even make the top 10, how are you preparing people for leadership? One of the most challenging things I had to do, and this was a project where I knew everything, we had to do an office reorg, 50 people, and I had to restructure where people sat. I thought World War III was going to break out. Mm-hmm. Trying to keep people happy. I don't want to be sat too far from the printer. I don't want to be, I'm too far from the coffee machine. I can't sit near him. I can't sit near the printer because it spouts out. I was pulling my hair out, trying to just keep people happy. And we were delivering a $10 million billing system, which we delivered on time, met the requirements, customers were happy. But getting 50 people comfortable with where they were sat and not having a drop in productivity, huge challenge, because it was all about it's all about the people.
Yeah.
And the quicker people learn that, the better they will, the quicker and higher they'll climb on the leadership ladder.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. And kind of going back, I love the fact that you kind of made that distinction between management and leadership, and going back to your story about the lady who thought she had breast cancer. Like to me, that was it, because I've actually had women talk about being in that very same position and having quote unquote leaders tell them, well, you know, look, that's not my problem. That's not my area of expertise. Go get it taken care of. Yeah. Can you do the project?
Yeah.
Zero empathy, zero care, zero concern. Mm-hmm. And we talk about it again, going back to employee disengagement. Do you think that that lady left that room wanting to do a killer job for the organization? Because she was just made to feel like she didn't matter. But when you take an approach like what you're talking about, and you show like just an ounce of empathy, that could go a long way, right?
Yeah. So one of the absolutely. So the last corporate permanent role I had, we created a culture, and I speak with a lot of people about defining cultures, and they want cultures of innovation, cultures of accountability, and we developed a culture in that organization which I think is the perfect culture, and it works for every organization, and it's you can. What we need to differentiate is between what the culture is we have and what it is we're trying to do. Those can be two different things. But too often people, they focus on the what aspect and try and shape a culture that they think will deliver an outcome rather than developing the right culture. And the culture we had, and it was designed by the organization, we sat down and we had a culture of we care. We care about our employees, we care about our customers, we care about the quality of the work that we do. And I tell you, when people feel that you care about them, you can get them to do absolutely anything. They will run through brick walls for you. If people don't think that you care about them, they become disinterested, disengaged, and they'll go and find people that do care, or companies that care for them. And leadership for me, it's all about showing people we care, because my success is dependent on everybody in the organization being successful. The more people that can be successful repeatedly, the better we're going to do. So for me, I have to care, and I have a duty of care to the team. So I've got to set them up to be successful. I've got to give them the tools that they need to do, and I need to make sure that they don't get burnt out, because I need them to be successful again next year and the year after and the year after. And creating that culture of we care and showing your team you care about them, if you do that as a leader, people will follow you anywhere. People will want from other teams will come and want to work for you.
100%. And that's, again, you know, and I've talked about this quite a bit on this podcast and past episodes, but, you know, this is one of the things that a lot of people who aren't veterans are shocked to find out that is at the root of great military leadership. Like,
oh, yeah.
As a Marine, that whole piece was ingrained. You better care about the person to the left and right of you because they're going to care about you. And if you guys don't care about each other, then it's not going to end well for anybody. And so it's not touchy-feely type stuff. This is the thing that successful organizations do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got your back. You've got my back. I interviewed a guy called Ed Heiner, and he was the Navy SEALs based out in San Diego. He was the head of training. All of the SEALs went through the training, and I interviewed him and I asked him what style of leadership. Do you have a style of leadership that the SEALs look for? And he said, our style of leadership, it's all about servant leadership. We are here to serve. And I was like, really? And he said, yeah, absolutely. We want to be putting our men in the best place possible. We want them to feel that we've got their back, that we are fully supporting them, because we're putting them into life and death situations. If you put people into a life and death situation without I'm here to serve you mentality, they're going to pick up on that at some point, and you're not going to get the best out of them.
Yeah.
So, and I was, you know, once he explained it to me, I thought, wow, that makes a lot of sense. But you know, if you'd have asked me at the start what kind of leadership do we have, I don't think I would have said servant leadership. But that's the style they're gone for.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, because it's kind of the Hollywood effect, right? I mean, they always glorify the kind of the spitting, slobbering, screaming, yelling, authoritarian command and control. And
yeah.
Sure, that happens, but you know, we call those folks bad leaders just like everybody else.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. Like at the end of Marine Corps boot camp, we do kind of like a mini hell week. It's only 2.5-3 days like the SEALs. And that's kind of that's the unspoken outcome of that, right? Is sure, they want to test your physical endurance. They want to see where your breaking point is. But it's, are you, after being deprived of sleep, deprived of food, made to do all these things when you're kind of at those worst points,
yeah,
are you going to dig deep and continue to lead your team, or are you going to break and turn your back on them?
Well, I think one of the – I don't like the wording in and around that, in that are they trying to break people? I don't think they are. I think they're trying to make people. If we put you, you know, the Romans used to have this strategy of their training was bloodless battles. And if we absolutely put people through the toughest situation they can in a friendly environment, when they go into a hostile environment, yeah, it might have felt like hell during that hell week, but you know what? If you go through that and get on the other side, you're now prepared for pretty much anything that's going to come to you.
Yep.
And they used to say that about the Romans. Their training was bloodless battles, and their battles were bloody training. And they've just prepared people to go and do that.
Yep.
And I think, as I say, I would characterize that as making people, not breaking people. And if people don't succeed in being made, then you know the best thing for them to do is to step back and don't put themselves into that environment.
No, I 100% agree with that assessment. There, it's that's spot on, because exactly, I mean, that's it, right? Is it's that whole idea behind, you know, anybody can lead in the good times.
Yeah.
What are you going to do when things get rough? And like you said, that's a safe environment for somebody to actually break if they can't stand up to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think this is why, you know, we come back, you know, to talk about football. You know, anybody who plays for Alabama and wins all 13 games, 30, 40, 50-0, yeah, that looks good, but you know, we're looking to see who are those quarterbacks that came back from 20 points down in the fourth quarter.
Yeah,
who can do it when the team morale is rock bottom and pick the team up by the scruff of the neck and turn it around? And anybody can quarterback a winning team. Can you do it when the team's 14, 21 points down and bring them back? That's the test of leadership. Doing it when the going is rough, not when the going gets going is easy.
100%. Yeah. No, and that's what. So I always like to kind of throw this out there because you know, a lot of people, we've already talked about them. They like to talk about Alabama. They like to talk about the Patriots. They talk about that. Yeah. But are you familiar with the New Zealand All Blacks?
Oh, my number one sport is rugby. I just watched Great Britain come from behind to beat the Springboks at the weekend. So, yeah, I'm very, very familiar with the All Blacks.
Oh, well,
very
there you familiar. Go, right? We talk about culture and sustainability. And
yeah.
They've been around since, what, like early 1900s?
I think their first test was like 1891 or something like that.
Right. Okay, yeah. So... And I don't know what the numbers are now, but the last I saw, over that span, they've won something like, it's like 85 or 90% of their games.
Yeah.
I mean, and absolutely. That's just amazing and when you think about it.
And they have a population of 3 million. A country with a population of 3 million. I think they have something like 30,000 players to pick from, and England has over 300,000. Yeah. And yet they kick our asses every year.
And it's, you know, but again, it goes to that culture, right? It's not always more is better. It's not always, it's you, and you know, I've seen a couple of documentaries on them. And again, it's a thing, they don't recruit, people come knocking on their door.
Oh, people are queuing up. There's a great video. I do a breakthrough leadership training course, and I just did the one on culture last week. And there's a great video on YouTube. If you go onto YouTube and if you put in the history of the hacker, there is a 4-minute video where the guy talks about the hacker and what it means to play for New Zealand and how they teach the culture of the New Zealand rugby union team. It's not the culture of the team. It's the culture of the country. They've got people practicing the hacker in junior school, hoping that one day they will get to be an All Black. And everybody, it's drilled into them from a young age, this is what it means to be an All Black. And the hacker that they do, Katame, it was written over 100 years ago by a tribe that were on the verge of extinction, and they went into their last battle and they did the haka, and it's do or die. We're going to leave everything here. You know, we're small, but we're going to come and stick it right to you. And they get to do that before every game and reinforce it and look around, look each other in the eye and restate their culture. And every single player buys into it. And this is why they are the best in the world. And as you say, I think they have about an 85% winning percentage. They've won the World Cup. I think they've won the World Cup a third of the times that it's been played. They hold the record for the longest unbeaten run, something like 30-35 games, and it's a country of 3 million people.
And it's that culture piece too. Like I said, I can't watch that haka and not get, you know, I'm not even playing, but not get tingles. And I'm sitting there
absolutely.
Like, you know, and I don't know how the rules are 100% written, but that's one of the, like, if I'm the opposing team and I've got a set and watch them do that, and like, I have to watch them and they're looking at me basically saying, hey, I'm coming for you. Like, I've already started off like a point or two behind because it's just that emotional thing that they get that I don't.
So I went to see Great Britain play New Zealand. So there's two types of rugby. There's rugby league and rugby union, and I played and watched both. And I saw the New Zealand rugby league team, which is not the All Blacks. It's like the difference between Canadian football and American football. And I went to see Great Britain play the New Zealand, the Kiwis are called, and they won 25-24 with a score in the last minute. And for some reason, God only knows why, they didn't do the haka at the start of the game. And when it was, when they won 24-25, final whistle gets blown, and we were sat right behind the coach's dugout, and the whole New Zealand team came, and they were about 15 yards from me, and they did the haka. Oh my God, it was the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life. And this was the team that had won. They
Okay, well, folks, as you heard there, there was kind of an abrupt end. Apparently, the spirits didn't want us talking about the haka anymore, unfortunately. But yeah, but no, I mean, it was good. It's a culture piece, right? And it kind of ties back into the things we've been talking about with organizations, like, you know, the All Blacks, for instance. I guarantee you, they don't have a disengagement problem. They don't have these issues, right? And what I've noticed, again, kind of doing the cultural tie-in, is whenever they do have a player that has issues, that team has rallied around them, and if it's bad, the culture takes care of itself, right? They've got a self-sustaining organism.
Yeah. It doesn't need leadership to say, hey, you're out of line. The players will say, hey, that's not what an All Black does.
Yeah.
We don't do that around here.
And that's the gold standard right there, right? Mm-hmm. That's what every organization should strive for.
Yeah, when the organization has the right culture, and that culture is endorsed and lived from top to bottom, then it will police itself, and people who step out of line will be told to get back into line very, very quickly. Mm. You know, you can't be an All Black and just say, I don't feel like it today. That doesn't happen. It's all or nothing. We're putting our bodies on the line every single game.
Yep. And if you do, that is the end of the road, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You won't get picked again.
Well, I was going to say real quick, that goes back to what we're talking about with SEALs, right? Because here's the one thing that a lot of, again, media talks about SEAL training is ringing the bell. What they don't tell you is that candidate, they actually have an opportunity. After they ring the bell, they can take it back. But what they've noticed is, I think there may have been one or two, but it's almost like it's nearly a statistical 100%. That once you check out to the point where you do ring the bell, even if you decide you want to stay, you're already done. Because once you've given yourself an out, you know it's there, and you're more likely to take it in the future.
Correct. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Gordon, before we get out of here, I want to I've heard a lot of stuff that you do. And folks, I'm telling you right now, if you're not following Gordon on social media, you need to. Like, between, you know, the content you put out, the YouTube videos you put out, you put out a ton of great content.
I do put out a lot of content. Yeah, I'm passionate about this.
I just heard you talking about one, and we'll get about this, because you're talking about this acronym, FAST, which stands for Focus, Accountability, Simplicity, and Transparency. But I got to ask this question here first before we talk about FAST here for the next few minutes. Do you really, I heard you giving a talk, and you mentioned that you try to get out 100 tweets a day?
150.
Good Lord. Okay. I'm assuming you don't do all of those, right? You probably use, like, tools.
I use some tools. Social Jukebox is a tool I use.
Okay. Okay.
Yep. Okay, and I've written 1,500 blogs, and I wrote all of – actually, it's probably closer to 1,600 now. But I wrote all of those. I am prodigious in content production.
Yes. Yes, you are. That is a great – that is might be the understatement of the year right there. All right. So let's talk about FAST here real quick. Let's talk about FAST real fast. Let's do that. So go for it.
So FAST is a process. I worked in IT for 30 years, and I was a turnaround expert. And I was coaching somebody, and he said, for an interview, and I said to him, what are your three strengths? And he said, I don't know. What are yours? And I said, actually, I don't know. I would have said, you know, honest, hardworking, persistent. But I thought, anybody can say that. Is there anything that actually defines me and what I do and makes me different to other people, or common qualities that other good leaders have? And as a turnaround expert, I was wondering, is there anything I do that is repeatable that I'm doing subconsciously, which are my strengths. And when I looked through it, I was I focused on three, and it was I tend to simplify things. And simplicity, it's about the how are we going to do this? And the simpler you make it to be understood, it doesn't necessarily need to be easier, but if people can simply understand what it is they need to do and they can see how they'll be successful, they'll try and do it. So we have to keep things simple. The next thing is about transparency. Do we know what's involved? I run marathons and people tell me, oh my God, I couldn't run 26 miles. It's not about running 26 miles. It's about running 500 miles during 26 weeks of training. If you can do that, the marathon's dead easy. If you don't do that, you're going to struggle. So we need to have the transparency of what's involved. And then do we have a feedback loop? Do we have a scoreboard that shows us, are we on track, yes or no? If we are, good job, well done. Pats on the back all round. If not, what do we need to change to get back on track? And then the third area was about focus. Are we focused on the right thing? If you're focused on the wrong thing, doesn't matter how much effort you put in, you're not going to fix it. And this is why, bringing it back to what we talked about at the start, if you see employee engagement as the problem, it's not, it's the symptom. And whatever you're treating the symptom, you're not going to fix it. You've got to focus on management engagement. Management engagement's the problem. Recruit the right people, give them the right training, and teach them how to engage people. So we've got to have the right focus. And that's about the what. Do we know what our goal is? Do we know what success is? And I was telling a friend, you know, my three strengths are simplicity, transparency, and focus. And he said, what about accountability? You're pretty good at that. And I went, yeah, if I had to do four, it would be accountability. And accountability is about the who. Who's involved? Have we set them up for success? Have we communicated to them what our expectations are? And if you do that, if you have the right focus, the right what, the right accountability, with everybody knowing what their role is and the expectation. If you've kept it simple so they understand how they're going to be successful, and you've got transparency into what needs to be done and the progress you're making, you not only eliminate the causes of failure, because those are the four key causes of failure, you actually accelerate the speed with which you achieve results, because focus and accountability allow us to be more effective. Simplicity and transparency allow us to be more efficient. And when you're effective and efficient, you are going to achieve results fast. So that's kind of like my 2-minute summary, 3-minute summary of FAST. Worked every time.
Yeah, no, I love it. That's why I want to make sure that we got that piece out there, because I think that is gold right there. I love that breakdown.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we did say that we would talk about that a little bit more, but I think the conversation we had has been valuable. And as we said, for the readers, I will offer an opportunity for people to be able to download a free PDF version of FAST, so they can go and read that and understand more about it. And it is a tool. You can use it in your personal goals, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a multi-million dollar company. The principles of FAST will help you be more successful.
Yeah, no, I agree, and thank you for that. I'll make sure that link gets in the show notes. And you know, I got to ask before we kind of start to wrap up here. We did cover a lot of ground, but is there anything that we didn't get a chance to cover that you really want to leave listeners with?
Yeah, I think so. And given what we've talked about, I think, you know, one of the questions people ask is, are leaders born or made? And to be honest, leaders are made. But what we do is we do get dragged down that expert path, and we tend to promote experts. But anybody can lead. And I would seriously recommend to anybody, if you want to be a leader, it's good to be an expert and understand the strengths of what you do on your day-to-day business, but you've got to develop your leadership skills, understand your emotional intelligence, how to improve and drive that forward, understand how to engage and inspire people, and we talked about earlier, just showing them that you care is a huge, huge step in that direction, and then look and see how you can empower people. And if you get that whole people aspect mastered and you've got good technical capability, you'll be unstoppable as a leader. So anybody can do it, but you've got to go out. And I offer leadership training, and I'm not saying come and do my training. You can go out. There's hundreds of books you can read. Go watch videos by Simon Sinek. Go on some leadership training. Take whatever courses you want, but invest in that development. And if you do that, your leadership will improve significantly.
No, I love it. Well, you may not say it, but I will. go check out Gordon's training. Go check out the training that I provide at the Leadership Phalanx. These are things that people really need. And Gordon, for your training, again, I'll go ahead and encourage people, go get Gordon's training, but where can they find it? Let them know where they can find the links to your training, how to get signed up, and your social media.
So simplicity. I have the pleasure of being the absolute only Gordon Treadgold in the entire world. So if you want to find me, just go and Google Gordon Treadgold. That will bring up my website, my Twitter account, my Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, the articles I've written on Inc. and Entrepreneur. I am the only Gordon Treadgold in the world. So just put Gordon Treadgold in Google and you will find me. And feel free to reach out and connect. You know, it's difficult to be an advocate of we care and to encourage people to connect and then not respond back to them. So I'm a very approachable and responsive person. And if you reach out with questions about anything, I'll be more than happy to come back and give you some guidance and direction.
Yeah, definitely. And I can vouch for that. I love what you've been doing. Keep up the great work. And
thank
folks.
You.
Get out there and definitely take advantage of everything that Gordon has to offer and reach out. Well, brother, it's been fantastic. I don't want to take you away from the beautiful Spain weather any longer.
It's 10 o'clock. Yeah. It's wine o'clock.
It's wine o'clock. Love it.
It's wine o'clock.
It. Well, brother, again, thank you very much for spending, last 50 plus minutes with myself and my listeners. This has been a treat. I think we covered a lot of ground, and there's a lot of stuff here that is going to help a lot of leaders. So thank you for having this discussion with me.
My pleasure.
All right. And listeners, I know you had a good time. I'm going to have all the links to all that good stuff in the show notes. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns for me, you know how to just reach out at burden.command@gmail.com. Whether it's for guest ideas, story ideas, you got a question for me, you need to figure out how to reach out to one of my guests, whatever it is, reach out to me on there. And keep up the good work with rating, subscribing, reviewing, and sharing the show so my great guests like Gordon can have their content shared even further, although he's doing a great job with 150 tweets a day himself already, but you can help him do an even better job. So thank you for that. And again, listeners, thanks for spending the last almost hour with us. And I look forward to speaking with you all again in the next episode.